Some observers of the American body politic say things like the country has never been so divided. What they probably should say is the country has never been so divided in my lifetime, because we've been divided plenty through the years. The Civil War is a prime example, but there are many more through our history, back to and even before the Revolutionary War that created the country in the first place. Our guest this hour tracks that history in detail. Richard Kreitner is the author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, in which he makes the case that the United States has seldom been truly united. Richard Kreitner writes about politics, history, and literature, and has been published in several places. He's a contributing writer for The Nation and is the author of a previous work, Booked, A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations Around the World. Richard Kreitner, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Hey, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It is a pleasure. I have to ask about the subtitle first. What makes what you tell here a secret history?
Well, it's really not that well known. You know, as you mentioned, I think most people associate secession, certainly disunion, with only, you know, the Civil War, the Confederacy, the South, slavery. Not many people know that, you know, practically every part of the country, every group, has at one time or another at least thought about leaving the Union, entertained the idea that, maybe it's not working anymore and we should break off on our own. And really no era has been entirely free from this question. There have been times, as you mentioned, you know, in recent history where it was more buried than at other times, but it's never really gone away. And, you know, I, as the book shows, you know, the country was fragile from the beginning, and it's never really been a strongly united country.
So for the really broad overview, is division the norm and not the aberration?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it has been from the beginning. You know, when the first, you know, English colonists who came here, or you know, what we often confuse as the first ones, because, of course, Jamestown was a little bit earlier, but the Pilgrims, so-called, in New England, you know, the Mayflower set sail 400 years ago this season. You know, but they didn't call themselves Pilgrims. They called themselves Separatists. And that was because they wanted to secede from the Church of England and establish their own independent congregations. And that was illegal, you know, at the time. So that's why they left. And that kind of separatism, I argue, and I think show in the book, has been there from the beginning. It's kind of deeply ingrained in American political DNA. Anytime, you know, something wasn't working, you could just get up and start your own town. Or try to start your own country.
Which is, that's a great lesson for people to keep in mind. The fact is that even some of the people who started the country, at least in the northern colonies, were about being there because they couldn't get along with people in the place they came from.
Right, exactly. And you know, and that's true as well as American history continues. You know, who was leaving for Oregon in the 1840s? It was people who were okay with leaving the borders of the United States as they then existed. And you know, they were fairly ambivalent as to whether its borders were then extended to include them. A lot of people at the time, you know, I'm sure we'll get to this, were perfectly okay with forming a separate Pacific Republic on the West Coast. And the very people who get up and move on are often the types who are not, you know, so intent on holding to, you know, standards from the past and are willing to try something new.
So you write in the book that we pay a price for unity as our highest priority. How high a price is it?
Well, sometimes, you know, it can be a very high price, different at different times. You know, the book, I began the project with the supposition, the hypothesis that maybe the price was too high today. I wasn't really quite sure of that at the time, and I'm still not too sure of it. So I was interested in doing a kind of historical investigation of who in the past had that idea, had asked these questions and come to similar conclusions about whether the Union was worth, you know, breaking apart. And I was especially interested in people who ask the question for kind of noble reasons, you know, not for pro-slavery reasons. But, you know, I swiftly found that there are plenty of anti-slavery people, abolitionists, who thought that the country should break up, you know, in the decades before the Civil War, because they thought that the Union and the Constitution as it then stood, you know, gave countenance and support to the institution of slavery. So, you know, for them, the cost of the Union was the perpetuation of human bondage, which to them was unconscionable. And in order to end slavery, they thought that you had to end the Union. You know, because, you know, especially during the 19th century, which is, you know, the bulk of the book, of course, compromise meant perpetuating slavery. That's what it meant. You know, the North didn't care as much about ending slavery as the South did about continuing it. And that enabled these political compromises, which, yes, held the country together, but at the cost of, you know, perpetuating probably one of the worst crimes in human history. And, you know, I wonder what the cost is today. You know, right now, you have people like Mitch McConnell denouncing the idea of a blue state bailout for states that have been totally hammered by the coronavirus and the subsequent economic lockdowns and stuff. But of course, the balance of payments goes precisely the other way, where blue states tend to pay more in taxes than they get back in services, and the opposite is true for red states. I don't think that's a reason to end the union in itself, but I have found that this year of great stress and turmoil and crisis, people are starting to talk about things along those terms. In a way that is reminiscent, I think, of earlier periods of American history.
So speaking of those earlier periods, Walt Whitman, the poet, keeps popping up. Why was he glad to see the rupture of the Civil War?
Yeah, that's he's kind of my literary, touchstone.
Uh-huh.
He had seen, as many people did at the time, that this was a long time coming, that these fissures were only growing in the United States and that things needed to come to some kind of climax or turning point, and so that the country could decide whether or not it wanted to be united. He saw people on both sides of the partisan or sectional divide questioning the value of the Union and whether it was worth continuing. And he thought it was. He thought that like Lincoln at the same time, he thought that the United States had some kind of great promise for humanity itself, not just for the American people, and was worth maintaining for the sake of that, for the sake of democracy, basically, in a word. And so he was happy to see things brought to a point where Americans would have to decide once and for all whether they wanted to be united. He hoped once and for all. I also note that after the Civil War, he was quite disappointed with the way things were turning out in the country. He thought that it was too devoted to profit, to corporate power,
mm-hmm.
and not enough to, the kind of democratic, egalitarian ideals that he thought the Civil War had been fought on the basis of.
Huh.
What I especially find in Whitman is this kind of sense that it could go either way, which, even when I started the book about 5 or 6 years ago, I also thought that it seemed like we were coming to some kind of crisis and we were going to have to decide, what kind of country we wanted to be.
All right. Back to Richard Kreitner and Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Richard, let's come back to Walt Whitman, because he was disappointed that the Civil War didn't seem to have. I mean, so he was glad that at least the rupture came and it put everything on the table, and the war settled things, he thought, but then didn't. I mean, is part of the reason for the book a plea for Reconstruction finally finished and done right?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I think Reconstruction is the time where the idea of the Union was joined to a very, progressive in the best way. An egalitarian vision of what the country could be, effectively a multiracial democracy. And for various reasons, that mission, that project was aborted or annulled, left incomplete. And that's largely, I think, because the white North grew tired of the entire question. They had fought the war really not to emancipate the slaves, but to save the Union. And it became clear afterwards that everyone, North and South, was, slavery itself aside, was kind of happy to go back to the status quo antebellum, which allowed the South to determine its own racial affairs, which is to say to institute racial apartheid, which we call Jim Crow, which in some cases was slavery in everything but name. And the North, was okay with that. They just wanted to kind of, get on with things and make money and expand to the West. And basically launch out on a project of empire. So it renewed this bargain that had effectively, been there from the founding of the country and had only broken down once, that led to the Civil War. And this bargain over, states' rights or racial domination lasted, until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s. And from that point, when that compromise broke down again, our politics have never really recovered from.
Mm-hmm. That is true. I mean, we're still looking at the realignment of parties that grew out of the civil rights years. It was Lyndon Johnson himself, as he signed either the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, said, "I've pretty much consigned the uh, the South to the Republican Party for a generation. He was a little short on his time frame there, but that's right. What we're talking about here. Let's go back to the beginning, because we've already talked about the Pilgrims as separatists. You know, the people who came to Massachusetts were running away from another situation they didn't particularly like, and then there were other colonies created, like Providence, split off from the Massachusetts colony. And we learn that the reasons for other colonies differed. This is a ground we've gone over with Colin Woodard. I don't know if you've read his book, American Nations, but very different reasons for people to be in the various places they were in North America.
Right, right. And then they did different things once they got there. They had different forms of government. They had different religions. They had especially different economic interests. And you know, what that basically, you know, his book is excellent on this stuff. What that basically did was it meant that they really wanted nothing to do with one another. You know, we skip over the colonial period pretty quickly, but it was a full century and a half between, you know, the first settlements in New England and Virginia and the American Revolution. That's the same period of time since the Civil War, very, very long time. And the reason why they never joined together wasn't because nobody had thought of the idea. It's because they wanted nothing to do with it. They didn't want to join together. You know, we have this famous cartoon that Benjamin Franklin made of a disjointed snake, and it says, "Join or die." And that's, you know, in 1754, he introduces this plan for the colonies to join together. But they reject it out of hand. They want absolutely nothing to do with it. And it's not until the Revolution that they agree to join together. But even when they do it, it's a means to an end. You know, they didn't form a nation. They didn't declare independence so as to form an independent and united nation. They formed a nation in order to declare independence. They realized that they couldn't fight the war on their own and beat, you know, Britain, the most powerful military in the world. So, you know, the Union was always a means to an end, never really an end in itself. And that meant that any time it seemed to not really serve those ends, people, you know, turned against it. And some of the same people who fought the Revolution or even, you know, wrote the Constitution endorsed secession in the early period of the American Republic is when it seemed like the country was going in a direction that they didn't approve of. You know, this has always been with us. And then, you know, hasn't gone away.
Well, you point out, though, that as early as 1739, we had the likes of Martin Bladen talking about actually uniting the colonies as a country. And there was an example of union right here in the North American continent already. How cohesive was we call it the Iroquois, but the Haudenosaunee Confederation?
Great question. Yeah, this was one of my favorite, you know, sections of the book to write. They were actually very united. It was a very successful project, a very sophisticated form of political organization. And it enabled the Iroquois to become, you know, really quite successful negotiators in the imperial diplomacy of the 17th and 18th century. And it drew the interest of French and English, you know, trappers or travelers, because they saw that the Iroquois, by forming these five nations into one confederation, had given themselves more power, more internal cohesiveness, and more peace among themselves than they otherwise would have had. And, you know, in the plan of union that I just mentioned and that Benjamin Franklin put forth in 1754, I think there's a good case to be made. It's not totally conclusive, but I think there's good indication that he drew on the model of the Iroquois in forming this confederation, which ultimately inspired the American Union as it was created in the Revolutionary War. I quote a Iroquois chief who made a speech at a conference with colonial officials urging them to unite on the basis of the Iroquois model. And, you know, that treaty, the conference that was a part of, made its way into Benjamin Franklin's hands because he had a job printing these transcripts for the Pennsylvania colonial legislature. And I think that's where he got the idea of forming a union. Not necessarily that he wouldn't have thought of it otherwise, but this was the model that was, you know, very close to hand. And he read up on the Iroquois, and he knew exactly how their confederation worked. And he thought that if it worked for them, it would probably work for the colonies as well.
So you describe the Revolution actually as the first civil war. I mean, and when you stop to think of, I mean, there's a lot of things that I have to think about anew here, because I'm familiar with the story of the Dominion of New England, where the Crown wanted to consolidate the New England colonies into one entity. And having gone to high school in Connecticut, that's a story told a very different way. You know, we got the Charter of Connecticut out of the room and hid it in an oak tree. There's the Charter Oak in Hartford that appears on the Connecticut Quarter. I mean, it was a big deal to resist the central power even then.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I mean, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, and I didn't hear anything about that story. And it's just such a great story. I think so indicative of, You know, I think there are questions as to how true it is,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that subsequent generations of people in Connecticut and New England more generally kind of held to it and saw it as this origin story, you know, this early iteration of American kind of ingenuity, but also anti-authoritarian, you know, sentiments, is very interesting. You know, but what that shows to me, that was effectively a revolution that the New England colonists launched in 1689. You know, we think that the first American Revolution was created a union in 1776, but it was actually 70 years earlier, and it destroyed a union. It showed that the real American impulse is not towards unity, but towards disunity and kind of jealousy of your liberties, you know, which we're seeing quite a lot of today. You know, as for the revolution being a civil war, I mean, again, the national myth-making suggests that practically everybody supported independence, but it's not the case at all. It took a lot of protest, obviously, in order to get people behind independence, but also took a lot of street violence. You know, the Union, as it was created, was held together through these networks that effectively intimidated people. You know, we see this today with some protest movements and you know, mainstream, you know, opinion people kind of shake their heads at it. But that's exactly what the American Revolution was. It was all about intimidation and force and even, you know, torture. You know, that's what tarring and feathering is.
Mm-hmm.
The Union was held together from the very beginning by coercion.
So there's an interesting comment in here. I mean, you mentioned Benjamin Franklin already. George Washington gets in here himself briefly. Interesting to hear his perceptions of soldiers from colonies not mm-hmm. his own, not from Virginia.
Yeah, well, you know, the Revolution was the first time that a lot of these people in different colonies had interacted with people from elsewhere, you know, in North America. And they didn't exactly like what they saw. You know, George Washington was hired to serve as the commanding general of the Continental Army precisely because most of its troops were from New England, and they thought that hiring a Southerner would be a great way to, you know, achieve unity that was otherwise lacking. But he detested the New Englanders. He found them terrible soldiers, you know, smelly. I mean, you know, it gets quite personal. And the hostility went exactly the other way as well. You know, John Adams's letters from the Continental Congress in Philadelphia are very interesting on this point because he says that the Congress was more than anything else like an international assembly of diplomats from separate nations, and they barely knew how to talk to each other. You know, they were speaking the same language, but they didn't really know where everyone was coming from and what they meant by different things. And the hostility and the recriminations and even the secessionist threats begin right then, you know, even before the states declare independence.
Richard Kreitner is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a contributing writer for The Nation, writing about politics, history, and literature. And he's put together a bang-up book about the fact that political division is not something new in this country, not by a long shot. The book is called Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. It's a conversation you are welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hiya. Great. Hi. Program. Thank you. About 45 years ago, Ernest Kallenbach wrote a book called Ecotopia. And an even better book that he wrote after that is called Ecotopia Emerging. I highly recommend folks read it. And let's say on January 20th, Donnie, you know who I'm talking about, is still in office and won't leave. I've heard some people talking about, we're going to have secessionist movements happening all over again. I used to kind of be in favor of that, but now I'm a little worried with international situations with the Russians and the Chinese and other people who don't like this, probably for good reasons, gaining in power and influence and all that. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts just on the future in terms of we human beings in North America, how we might relate to each other if things start getting really heavy in the early part of 2021.
Yeah, okay, good question, and thanks for the offer to read Ecotopia again, which I have. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Thoughts, Richard?
Yeah, great questions. A lot in there. I have read Ecotopia as well. It's a great novel. I haven't read the sequel, but I'll check it out. The idea of a Pacific Coast Republic, as I think I mentioned sort of glancingly, is I kind of tell the prehistory of that idea in the 1840s and 1850s in the book. And I think that the you know, if California and Oregon and Washington, or perhaps also British Columbia, were to secede from the Union, I think that would be really quite a viable nation. As for the international kind of complications, that's also very interesting because it reminds me of the founding period, which is, European powers were kind of circling the United States as a young republic that really shouldn't have existed at all by rights, and preying on its divisions in the same way that foreign adversaries like Russia and China are doing today, and even sponsoring separatist movements at the time in the Trans-Appalachian region, in Kentucky, separatist movements, as, you know, Russia has been somewhat involved in, yes, California, a California secessionist movement, and in Texas today. And yes, I certainly think that both Russia and China, and perhaps others, would try to take advantage of a fracturing United States. But I kind of think that's happening already and is bound to happen regardless. You know, I do think that that American influence in the world, if you want to call it that, or the American empire, if you want to call it that, is on the wane. And that's going to lead to, you know, other rival powers rising and taking advantage of American divisions. So I definitely think, I guess that's a reason to oppose fracture or disunion or secession today. But I think it's going to be something that we're going to have to wrestle with in any case, as you know, we did in an earlier period of American weakness,
right
at the very, very beginning.
And as you point out, it's a feeling that has been there among at least some portions of society since before the beginning. Here's Nikki in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a similar question. It's about military. How would we envision the military dissolving, or would there still be a common defense if there were separate nations?
All right. Excellent question. Thanks for that, Nikki.
Yeah, great question. I mean, you know, the book is not a programmatic call to arms, you know, to break it up. It's break it up as the theme of the book, and it's a history of different proposals that have been made throughout time. So, I specifically was trying to avoid answering difficult, thorny questions about the military or, you know, what happens to the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, to irresponsibly venture a couple ideas. I think that instead of disunion, one thing that we might want to think about is called devolution, you know, perhaps radical devolution, which would be, instead of breaking up the country, we break it down into, you know, 8 to 10, maybe 12 regions of the United States, the Northwest, the Northeast, South, the Midwest, you know, the Southwest. And you know, we would maintain the United States of America as kind of a European Union-style umbrella within which you have these, you know, highly devolved regions that handle lots of things, but not the military. So we would maintain, you know, a united military that's probably smaller and less, you know, eager to go on adventures abroad. I think that's probably a good thing. But then you don't have the complications of, oh, what happens to military bases in California or Oregon if those states actually secede entirely from the United States. You know, that could be a form of truce to say, you know what, let's stop deciding or trying to fight over every single issue in Washington, D.C. Let's bring power a little closer to home and but maintain the United States, you know, for external military purposes.
Well, you know, ultimately, I think it gets to a question of thinking of ourselves somewhat differently based on the way we look at the rest of the world. When those of us who are old enough to remember a functioning Yugoslavia think back to the time when Marshal Tito died and he basically held it together by force, that then you had the break off of Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina and so forth. But you know, as much as we can clock on our side of the world about, well, why didn't they just keep things together? It's like, it's an interesting question for us as well then, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Yugoslavia is a great example of what we would not want to happen, of course, you know, in a situation of national dissolution. What happened to Czechoslovakia about the same time, you know, where they split off quite amicably, is a counterexample. I think, I frankly think we'd probably be a bit more like Yugoslavia, which is extremely concerning. Mm-hmm. and would be quite ugly. And, you know, as I say, the book is not a call to arms. It's a call to think about this, because I think that it is happening to us, whether we like it or not. And it's, you know, only by thinking consciously about that, about deciding how we feel about it, about whether we want the Union to stay together, what we are willing to give up in order to allow that to happen, will enable us to take control of the process and decide. Because I do think that if we want to stay together, you know, there are certain steps that we can take towards that. And if we don't, then I think there might be ways to manage it peacefully, as long as we all decide, you know, beforehand to do that. I think that allowing disunion to happen to us sort of passively is how you get into scary situations like Yugoslavia or, you know, like the American Civil War, where, you know, one side wanted to fight to keep it together, and perhaps that was good, but, you know, 750,000 people died, which would be 8 million people today. So, you know, I don't think I'm willing to go to war to keep, you know, Cascadia in the Union. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's worth talking about that beforehand.
Yeah, a lot to think about and a lot more to talk about here. And we'll get back to some of the history as well. Before we go to the break, Napoleon in Klamath County sent in an email saying, don't think about secession. This is what Russia wants. They are still funding these secessionist movements. Dark money is funding a good portion of Republican politics right now, says Napoleon. Listen to Gaslit Nation. The GOP works for Russia just like Trump. Thanks for that, Napoleon. Thanks, Richard Kreitner. We'll come back to talk more about Break It Up and its history of secessionist thinking when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. I want to go back to some of the things that we talked about, Benjamin Franklin admiring the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Confederacy and thinking this is something we could do. We got a Confederacy. We got the Articles of Confederation to come behind the Declaration of Independence. What are some of the, the differences are rather striking, it seems, between the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. Major ones. You know, for one thing, the Constitution is easier to amend, which is strange because it's extremely difficult to amend. But the Articles of Confederation required unanimous support. So all 13 states needed to support a amendment to ratify the Articles in order for it to pass. And that is what locked up American politics in the 1780s and made it impossible, really, to govern. They couldn't raise taxes. They couldn't pass trade retaliation against Britain, which was dumping cheap goods in the American market. Basically to reverse American independence. So that is why the framers eventually decided to just rip up the Articles of Confederation extra-legally, you know, it's effectively a coup d'etat, and write a new constitution because the first one was totally impossible to work. You mentioned the name of the country. If you don't mind, I just wanted to give a little riff on that because
sure.
It's really quite interesting. The it's an awkward name for a country. You know, it's not like China or Indonesia,
right.
The United States of America. It's kind of a claim. It's an aspirational name because the states were not united at the time, as they all knew, and they were hoping that over time it would become true. But the guy who gave it the name was John Dickinson. It's kind of a B-list founding father these days. And he was, you know, a leading revolutionary in the 1760s at the very beginning of the protest movement. He came up with the famous, you know, rallying cry, which we still hear a lot today, "United we stand, divided we fall." But come 1776, John Dickinson was the only founder, the only person at the Continental Congress who would not sign the Declaration of Independence. He absolutely refused to do so. And that was because he said that we weren't united. The colonies did not have enough in common, and that if they declared independence and tried to form a separate country, it would fall apart, and there'd be a civil war. He thought within 15 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, and then right after he refused to sign the Declaration, he gave them the first draft of the Articles of Confederation. That was his job to draw it up. And that's when he gave it the name United States of America, even though he had just gotten through saying we're not united. So this is kind of like, you know, secret history embedded in the name itself.
Sure. Definitely aspirational and not technical as it existed at the time or since necessarily. So come back to the idea of we've heard about this a lot over the years, the idea that what became a constitutional convention came together ostensibly to revise the Articles of Confederation and essentially chuck them out the window metaphorically. But explain your writing of the Constitution as a document to protect the 1% of its time.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 1780s, in addition to there being secessionist movements in the West, in places like Kentucky and what's now Tennessee, there were also rebellions, populist rebellions in the East, especially in Massachusetts, which we now call Shays' Rebellion, led by Daniel Shays, a Revolutionary War veteran, and other veterans who were suffering in this post-war economic depression, and were pushing the states, which had most of the power under the Articles of Confederation, to grant them relief. You know, tax relief, debt relief, to abolish debts, you know, in the more radical versions of the idea. And this was extremely alarming to people like James Madison and George Washington, you know, who were quite wealthy for the time, really the 1% of that time. And so they needed a new constitution which would take power from the states and give it to a stronger central government, which for various reasons they thought, especially Madison, would be more insulated from popular complaint, from popular uprisings like Shays' Rebellion. And so they, you know, drew up this constitution in secret in Philadelphia. You know, only the, you know, wealthy 50 or so of them had any idea what they were doing. And it included provisions that were directly opposed to this kind of populist economic movement that was rising throughout the country at the time, most especially banning the states from printing paper money, which these debtors and farmers were advocating so as to, you know, make life for them a little bit easier, but which the rich, you know, totally opposed. So there's been a lot of great work that I'm drawing on here, you know, in the last 20 years or so about this. But that event, you know, essentially the Constitution was kind of a counter-revolutionary document in that it was attempting to put the brakes on the revolution and prevent its kind of egalitarian sentiments from spreading too far.
Interesting, because when you think about the fact that you know, got like 3%ers today, and people who continue to talk about the fact that revolutions should be a more or less regular thing in the country, and the Constitution was really meant to put the brakes on that, and yet the people who are talking about revolution also often rely upon the Constitution,
yep,
as the basis for what they do.
Extremely confused, exactly. I mean, Jefferson, you know, famously wanted to rewrite the Constitution every 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a little extreme, but surely after 230, we can take another look.
Well, but and it's interesting too, because you describe the process of the Constitutional Convention as a summer of hostage takings and high pressure standoffs, and it certainly did have to get ugly and ended up with a document that was like the country, made up of a bunch of different parts. It seems like then kicking the can down the road, something we talk about now, has always been the way of our leaders.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is effectively what keeps the country together, you know, in the first place. Is precisely putting off divisive issues. You know, this is why I worry that should Trump be defeated in November, because in 2 weeks from now, you know, I worry about Joe Biden and other Democratic leaders saying, you know, ignoring all the crimes that he's committed, really, and saying, let's just move on from all that messiness. Whereas I think, you know, a far healthier thing for the country to do would take a very close look at it, see exactly what went wrong and what needs to be, you know, what places in the Constitution really need to be bolstered to prevent anything like the last 4 years from happening again.
So as we look again to the basic setup here, when we get back to things like westward expansion in the 19th century, in the context that you place in front of us here, it looks more like kids picking teams for sandlot baseball.
Yeah, I mean, as far as what country they have, you know, fidelity to.
Well, yeah, in the sense that you know, okay, we want these guys because they'll be a slave state. Okay, but then we want these guys because they'll be a free state.
Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely like that. I mean, it was definitely like that. But basically, what I'm trying to show with that period and you know what we now call manifest destiny is that America's destiny was never as manifest as in hindsight we tend to think it was. A lot of people at the time thought that if America had a manifest destiny, it was to break apart, it was to be disunited, and that it was very unlikely that the whole continent would be, you know, one country. Even people today who we associate with Western expansion didn't necessarily think that the West Coast would be part of the United States. You know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, who made the Louisiana Purchase and you know, sent Lewis and Clark into the wilderness to see what was there. When John Jacob Astor established the first American outpost in Oregon, you know, in Astoria, in, I think it was 1815, Jefferson wrote him a letter saying, congratulations, really great job, but that's probably going to be a separate country. You know, it's all the way on the other side of the continent. It'll be founded, you know, it'll be settled by white American Anglo-Saxon men, but probably will not be part of the United States, and that's fine. Even somebody like Daniel Webster, you know, who famously said, liberty and union, one and inseparable, he supported the idea of a Pacific Republic in California and Oregon, which again, would be, you know, populated by Americans, but wouldn't be part of the United States. So he actually, you know, in that instance, did think that liberty and union were separable, that liberty could take hold in more than one country at a time. And, you know, the entire North American map was kind of radically up for grabs. You know, a lot of people in California wanted to be independent. And you know, the fear of that happening, or Britain or France, again, you know, with these foreign rivals, you know, taking control of California is basically what led President James K. Polk to start the Mexican-American War, you know, on a pretext in Texas to basically give him an excuse to conquer and annex California.
So the concerns are similar today, then, from what we've talked about so far. And Napoleon wrote a secondary email about this, about being concerned that, you know, you get the likes of China and Russia hanging around, sort of like the countries you described circling around at the beginning of the Republic, thinking it was going to break up fairly soon. If we get further down the road of talking about having super regions or some other rethinking of the American map, does this not help out foreign powers?
Yeah, I'm really glad you circled back to that, because I wanted to mention that about Napoleon's email. I mean, that's true, you know, and I do detail in the last chapter of the book that Russia's involvement in seeding or supporting American separatist movements in the last 10 years or so. They've hosted conferences in Moscow and subsidized these American movements to attend. And they, in 2016, part of the, you know, Facebook disinformation campaigns was Russia starting Facebook pages, you know, about the Texas movement, for instance, that actually got like hundreds of thousands of followers. So this is definitely something that is going on. Excuse me. I just think that now, as in earlier periods of American history, it's not Russia that is creating the American divisions. It's not Russia that is even inspiring the idea of perhaps the United States breaking apart. It's always been there. They're simply taking advantage of divisions and ideas that are, you know, American in their nature. And the way to to combat that, I think, is not to simply complain about Russia or to banish ideas from our mind because Russia is also interested in those ideas, but to actually look at them and decide how we personally feel about it. I don't think that just because Putin would rejoice over a disunited United States means that we shouldn't also, you know, consider the advantages of that possible situation, not now, but in the future, and possibly in the not-so-distant future.
That's an interesting way to think about it, that the ideas actually come from here. He's just amplifying them.
Exactly. And that's true not only about secessionism, but, you know, things overall. And the reason why Russia has been really easily and quite cheaply able to meddle in American politics is because he saw that those divisions were here and could be exploited. You know, this is what George Washington's farewell address is all about. He's saying, beware of foreign powers preying on your divisions. But the problem is the division, not the foreign powers. That's just the, you know, the way the world works.
All right. How would you like to see the country proceed from this moment, to unite more or to think more in terms of the super regional idea?
Yeah, you know, I went back and forth on this every day while writing the book, which is why it's not a programmatic statement, but a history, where I'm, you know, basically trying to add up all of American history and kind of draw a line under it and see what it adds up to and see how I feel about it. I would like to give it one more shot, give true unity in the Whitman sense, in the Reconstruction sense, one more shot, a multiracial democracy. But I think that requires, you know, a lot. I think that requires possibly a constitutional convention to bring the charter up to date. I think it probably requires abolishing the Senate, which I see as kind of this useless leftover of colonial era divisions or a smuggling of the Articles of Confederation style government into, you know, our current one, which I think is completely undemocratic. You know, for instance, like it's something like 10% senators representing like 10% of the American people can block any bill under the filibuster. So, you know, first step would be getting rid of the filibuster. But if that's not enough, I would get rid of the Senate. I would definitely get rid of the Electoral College. I think we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission about race and you know, the inheritance of white supremacy in this country. And you know, finally, I think we need the Green New Deal in order to physically knit the country together in the same way that infrastructure projects like the Erie Canal or, you know, the New Deal, the original New Deal era, you know, Works Progress Administration did in the 1930s. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, my program. If I was running for office and actually wanted to unite the country or keep it together. But I'm not optimistic that that's going to be possible. So I'm basically offering up secession, not as a, you know, an option of first resort, but as an option of last resort, that if it doesn't really work out, you know, this might be an exit plan. And if we can agree to do it, you know, peacefully and amicably, it might be a best case scenario for, you know, what I think, given climate change and given growing polarization, is probably going to be, you know, quite a messy decade ahead, and certainly, you know, between now and 2050, very messy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I just want to encourage people not to be scared of the word secession because of either you know, Russia or the Confederacy, you know, 150 years ago. There's a whole history to the concept that is much bigger and broader than that. And in certain, you know, manifestations, more appealing.
Right. Okay. Well, you certainly laid out some history here and given us a lot to think about in terms of whether we choose to go ahead and go down the path we've already gone down or choose a different one. But lots of stuff to consider in there. The book is called Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. It's by Richard Kreitner, who's a contributing writer for The Nation. Thanks so much for joining us, Richard.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Really appreciate it.
All right. Take care of yourself. That will do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. If you're listening in the morning after Stardate, you'll hear The Takeaway. If you're listening in the evening after Stardate, you'll hear news from the BBC. The program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself and have a great day.